Good morning. It's time for the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Good morning. I'm J. Marie Schaefer.
And good morning. I'm Kim Hance.
And this is the Herzog Law Firm, Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour, where we talk about elder law matters, wills, trusts, guardianship, Medicaid planning, anything related to elder law and estate planning, we're going to talk about it. If you have a question, this is a call-in show. You can give us a call at 518-476-5900. And good morning, Kim. How are you on this cold morning?
I'm good. As we were just discussing, this is my favorite kind of weather. I love fall. I love all things fall. I love when it gets a little cool and you can put on a nice hoodie sweatshirt and bundle up under the covers. And yeah, this is where I thrive.
Which is kind of funny because you are from the South and from the heat. And maybe that's why you came north, right?
Yeah, I made it here accidentally and then just never left because I love it. I love living in the Southern Adirondacks and being able to explore and, and this summer was pretty sort of typical Southern summer. It was so hot and so humid and you just don't want to go out and do anything those days, you know?
Yeah, it was very hot and humid, right? Well, now you got your wish. It's cool, and it's time for pumpkin everything, right?
Yeah, I haven't quite broken into that yet. I'm still, I still have to cut the grass. So until I don't have to cut the grass, I consider it officially fall.
I saw pumpkin spice stuff starting to come out in August, so I think they're pushing it earlier and earlier every year.
Well, I actually saw some Christmas stuff out the other day, and I just thought that's just insane. So, yeah.
That's too early. Right. One thing in the fall weather coming, makes me think of our Alzheimer's walks, which are coming up. You want to tell us a little bit about what they are and why we do them?
Yeah, So as a lot of people may know, we are a corporate partner with the Alzheimer's Association of the Northeastern New York, which encompasses 17 counties from basically the Capital District out to the Leatherstocking region and then up north to the Canadian border. And within those 17 counties, we have 5 walks that... And we participate in 4 of those. And really the walks, we actually refer to them as sort of the world's largest support group. It's a day for folks to come together and raise funds and awareness for those caregivers and individuals who are living with Alzheimer's disease. What a lot of people may not know is we're really lucky with the Alzheimer's Association to have a really large staff, but the staff, we have boots on the ground staff, and those are program managers that actually do in-person care consultations and education programs and information and referral and really sit with families and help them, work through the disease and get to the resources that they need to get to. So a big part of the walk and the funds that we raise through the walk are helping, they stay right here, stays right here locally to help offset the cost of all of the free services that the association provides. Tomorrow is the first walks, and that's the one in Oneonta in the Leatherstocking region. And then we start moving into all of the walks that we have coming up in the capital region. I believe, let's see, the next one will be in Albany, and that one will be October 1st at the Crossings, and then followed by 2 walks on the 15th at Queensbury, which is the walk that I co-chair, and the Columbia Green walk, and then it will end up with the last walk, I believe, on the 22nd of October in Schenectady. So we love to have people join us. We love to have people, you know, form their own team and come out and see us. And, you know, if you can't do any of those, we have a great team page where people can log on and donate. So lots of ways to participate.
Right. If you go on to our website, herzoglaw.com, there we have an Alzheimer's resource page. And on there, there's some great information, you know, about some of the programs that the Alzheimer's Association gives. But there's also places where you could register for each of the walks, or as you said, or just get information about them. And, you know, not only are the walks great, but there's so many free educational seminars that the Alzheimer's Association offers. That sometimes we speak at. I know, Kim, you spoke at one, I think, this week, right?
Yeah, so we've, you know, we're back to doing in-person events, and one of the sort of the favorite events that the Alzheimer's Association has always done is has been the big caregiving conference that was always held in Albany. And, you know, just because COVID is still lurking around, we opted to break it out into regional sort of what we called mini caregiver conferences, and we just finished up the one in Queensbury this week. We had over 90 attendees, which was amazing. I was lucky enough to be able to present the Understanding Alzheimer's Disease section, as well as be on the panel, you know, just talking about the different issues and planning, of course, you know, working for a law firm and being a social worker, you know, helping people understand what types of things they need to plan for and why it's so important, particularly for somebody that may have a cognitive-related diagnosis. It doesn't have to necessarily just be Alzheimer's. I mean, there's so many other cognitive-related diagnoses out there that it's really important, you know, for folks to plan for.
Yeah, that's right. And it's, you know, similar diagnosis. It's just really great to kind of talk to other caregivers or other individuals who are going through that to just get some support, right? Just and get some information and ideas about how to, you know, make your life a little bit easier.
Absolutely. I can't speak enough. And, you know, again, to your point, like if you go to our website, herzoglaw.com, and under our About Us, we have, like you said, the Alzheimer's resource page, but it lists all of the upcoming programs that the association offers, in addition to links to all of our walks that we're participating in. So it's sort of a one-stop shop for all of those folks that may be looking for some resources and learning opportunities. You know, there are just lots and lots of great learning opportunities for through the association as well.
Yeah, that's right. It's a great resource. And that's kind of the benefit of having someone like you, Kim, on our staff, who is a care manager. It's some of the just additional support measures that you give to families that go beyond what me and David and Harry do in terms of the legal or financial planning. And it's just so great to have you part of the team. So I was just going to ask you some questions today about what you do. You know, we focus a lot on the legal and financial planning, which we will certainly get to. But, you know, how does your work fit into part of what we do? So gotcha. First I wanted to ask you, like, why is it important to have a care manager work with you?
Right. I mean, there are lots of reasons, but I think one of the biggest things when I describe folks like what is an aging life care manager or a geriatric care manager, as a lot of us, you know, oldies call it, it's really a holistic client-centered approach to really looking at what's happening with folks and look what's going on with, you know, health changes, working with families. I think working with a care manager, you know, we know we're sort of the link to all of the things that are out there. So we, you know, guide families to be able to help them make decisions and ensure that, you know, there's a quality of care and really the optimal life for folks. I so often when we're working with families, you know, growing up, you hear that, you know, as you get older, it's the golden years, right? And I think so often that's not the case for a lot of folks that we deal with. And so really working with a care manager is someone who can really help you access all of the things that are out there, have the tough help lead some of the tough conversations that need to be had, and really help understand them. We do things like assessment and monitoring. A big part of what I do is planning and problem solving. You know, really sitting down at the table and talking about different options. And, you know, when families sort of throw up a barrier, it's like, okay, well, let's see if we can work through that and see if we can look at some other avenues that are out there. You know, another big part of what I do is education and advocacy. And a lot of caregiver, you know, coaching, really helping caregivers understand how to be a better caregiver, you know.
And, yeah, we have a phone call for you guys. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but
great.
Okay, we're going to talk to Catherine and Ilian. And good morning, hi. Catherine. How you doing?
Good. Thank you.
Hi, Catherine. How can we help you?
Well, a friend gave me this number. My mom passed away, and her house, we'd like to keep the house in the family. And with inheritance money, I'd like to buy the house because my daughter would like it. But she's not in a situation to be able to get a loan at this time because she just did a career change and she's going into cosmetology, not real secure on that yet.
Right.
So I'm trying to figure out the best way to do this. Right now, the house had been put in, like, trust, I guess, for my brother. So my brother will be selling it to us, and he's mm-hmm. anxious to do this. Mm-hmm. And we just don't know how to tell him, do we sell it to her? But I'm going to be purchasing it with my inheritance. So, and my concern is that I'm 59, and it's going to mm-hmm. take her a while to pay for it. And I also, if I put it in my name, don't want her to not have it should I end up in a nursing home down the road or something.
Yes, that's true. So yeah, it's a little bit of a complicated situation there. So the trust is completely owned by the trust for your brother. Is that correct?
Once she passed away, I guess it was set up that years ago, like 10 years ago, she changed things and put his name on it, I guess, with the hopes that if she ever went in a nursing home that they wouldn't take the house. And so once she had lifetime use of the home and once she passed, it became his.
Okay. So if you're looking to buy the house from him, even though it's a relative, you know, in terms of, you're getting a mortgage, is that right, to buy it? Or are you using the funds directly?
Using the inheritance funds.
Oh, okay. So you're not getting a mortgage.
No.
Okay. So then it's really just kind of treated as a cash sale where you would buy it from him. That's, you know, you can get an appraised value or look at the tax assessed value and come to an agreement on the price and then enter into a contract to purchase it.
Yeah, we've done that, but I just don't know for him to say whose name to put on it when they sell it. My daughter's, mine, how do I secure things for me because I'm actually buying it, but yet secure it for her that should I ever end up in a nursing home, she still has a house.
Right. Well, there's really two ways you could protect it if you want to protect it in case you go in a nursing home. And one way would be to put it in a trust, you know, an irrevocable trust for yourself where you would be able that would protect the house. You would have rights to live there. You know, it would go to your daughter after you die. Another way to do it is a deed with a life estate where the property is in your daughter's name, but you have life rights to the property. That's another way to get it out of your name for Medicaid purposes. So there's, you know, some pros and cons to each way, but it's good that you're thinking about this, you know, at the age of 59, that you're thinking ahead, right? Because you have to do this, 5 years ahead, and you don't want to wait until later where, you know, it could possibly become almost too late to do the planning. So I think one of those two options is usually, would be the best.
Now, you said the first was an irrevocable trust with rights to live in the house. And what was the second option?
A deed with a life estate.
Deed with life of what?
A life estate.
Life estate. Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. That's in your daughter's name, but you're on there as having rights, you know, to the property for the rest of your life.
Okay. All right.
And, deciding which is best, I mean, I would give us a call when the office is open and we could get, you know, we don't want to go into all your personal details over the radio, but we could ask a few more questions and see which would really be the right way for you. But there's going to be a way to protect it and make sure that the house is protected for your daughter.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for calling. So our office number, if you or if anyone else has questions, you want to call our office during the week, is 518-465-7581. And if you want to give a call into the radio show, we're happy to take your questions. It's 518-476-5900. So, Kim, we were talking about some of the roles and the supports that you give to our clients. And I was, you know, this week I did one of our popular webinars, Aging in Place. And one of the things that you talk about during that webinar are what are some community supports. And I think that's one of the great benefits that you bring to a meeting with a client is all the supports that there are out there in the community. So I was wondering if you could give us some of your favorite ones.
Yeah, some of my favorite ones, and it's perfect timing right now, is one of the things that I always encourage people to do annually is, you know, we're coming up on Medicare open enrollment. And I encourage folks to meet with someone about their Medicare to kind of review it and talk about if there were any changes over the previous year. And really kind of talk about what you want from your Medicare plan. I mean, so much now that there's so many Medicare plans out there to try to sit and decipher it yourself is really a huge challenge. And so what's great is there's a service provided through every office for aging, every county through the Office for Aging. It's called HICAP. And you know, we always joke and say how much we love acronyms in long-term care, right? But it stands for Health Insurance Information Counseling Assistance Program. And what's so great about the HICAP program is you'll meet with an individual that is certified to understand every Medicare plan that's out there. And there's a formulary that they'll plug into the computer when they're meeting with you. So they're going to talk to you about your diagnoses, your medications, and the dosage of each medication. Because believe it or not, Medicare plans and the cost can even vary depending on, whether or not you take 10 milligrams of something or 20 milligrams of something, right? So they'll sit down with you. They'll plug it into their formulary. They'll pull up the plans that cover what you need or what you're looking for, and then they'll kind of talk to you about what does it mean to have a deductible plan. Maybe you choose a deductible plan that has no premium. Maybe you choose a plan that has no deductible but has copays associated with going to the doctor and going to see specialists and things like that. It's really super important, and one of the reasons we really encompass it in our aging in place is, as we know, healthcare can get expensive really fast. And I always use my dad as an example because when my dad retired, he worked for an airline for 47 years. retired with really great benefits. And so when he initially chose his Medicare plan, he chose one with a high deductible because he was like, I've got great health insurance, so, you know, I'm going to take the gamble and choose a high deductible Medicare plan because I really don't have a lot of health expenditures at this time. Fast forward 3 years, so he kind of chose that stuff, forgot about it, and fast forward 3 years, he had to have his hip replaced, and which is pretty common as folks get up into their 60s and 70s. And unfortunately, though, he had a lot of complications with that hip replacement. And with all of the, so he developed MRSA, became septic, almost died twice during this window of time, then it ended up having the hip being taken out for 6 months so that they could clean up all the MRSA that was developed. So, you know, because he had never really revisited that Medicare plan, and because Medicare is your primary insurance, and his other health insurance was secondary, he and my mom were taxed with all of these, it was the deductible, but then it was all of these copays that they had to manage. And it really, they were buried in medical expenses. And so I really just say to folks, it's a free service. It's a great way to really evaluate what your current needs are. And from an affordability, and most people, as we retire, we're on a fixed income. So we want to make sure that whatever it is that we're spending really matches what we're able to do. Even, you want to consider what happens if I have a health event, am I going to be able to afford, taking care of myself and paying whatever medical expenses are out there? And a lot of times, too, people decide that maybe they retire with, retirement. Part of their retirement package is health insurance, but that premium is going to be, $300 or $400 a month. We live in an age where, health insurance isn't included, generally speaking, in most retirement packages anymore. So you really have to evaluate, am I going to get, because you're already going to get Medicare, right? You've been paying into the system, so it's an entitlement. It's something that you automatically get and are eligible for when you turn 65. So do you really need to keep that health insurance from your employer that you've had for so long? And So they're really great at sitting in and running different scenarios with you and kind of talking about the pros and cons and the expense of it. $400 a month is a lot for someone who's on a fixed income to be paying out for, a different kind of health insurance or even copays or a deductible that may happen if something happens to them. So that's one of my favorites. we did talk a little bit about the Alzheimer's Association. That's another one of my favorite organizations that we work with. Sort of kind of tying on to the Alzheimer's Association, we also work very closely with both the Eddy Alzheimer's Services and the Caregiver Support Initiative, which is run through SUNY Plattsburgh up north. Both of those programs, in addition to a lot of what the Alzheimer's Association provides, they have respite available that's paid for through a grant that each of them oversee, as well as different kinds of social opportunities for both care partners and the individuals that are diagnosed, like memory cafes or what we call memory mixers, where they might go and do, just 2 weeks ago they did a paint and sip at an organization. They do, it's just a great outing for a lot of times as we see our families become isolated when this disease becomes part of the journey. And because they feel like they can't go out anymore, and maybe they're, embarrassed or, afraid of what might happen if they go to a friend's house or things like that. So these memory cafes and memory mixers are perfect social opportunities for the care partner and the individual with the diagnosis to be able to, get out and find some support and have some fun. Because I think that's the other thing that's really super important is remembering that even though, you know, you've got sort of this heavy diagnosis, you can still have fun and you still need to find ways to be able to do that.
Yeah, guys, we have a phone call here in about 3 minutes to the bottom of the hour. Would you like to wait or would you like to talk to our caller now?
Oh, we can take the caller now.
Okay, this is Christina from Greenwich. Hi, Christina. How you doing?
Hi. Good. How are you?
Good. How are you doing this morning?
Good. What a nice program it is that I listen to it quite often and find that it's just so informative. So thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome.
I had a question about special needs trust for a relative of mine that is on Social Security. So I'm looking to open up. He's on disability. So I know that of a special needs trust, but I was more interested to know, like, what are the rules and how it works pretty much and how much something like that runs.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, sure, that's great. So a special needs trust, it's also called a supplemental needs trust, is a trust for someone who's, you know, receiving either, you know, Social Security, disability, Medicaid, other government benefits. And because of those benefits, there's certain asset limits that they have. Their assets can't be above a certain amount. So if they have their own money that's in excess of that, or if someone else wants to give them money, the best way to do that is in a supplemental needs trust, which is so that trust won't count, you know, against their resource limit. But the money in the trust can be used for them. So generally, it can be used for anything that they need. Really, the one rule about that is you can't give them cash directly, but you can pay for services that they need or buy things that they need out of the trust. And, you know, again, as I said, generally for almost anything. One exception is if they're receiving SSI and you pay for housing costs, that can reduce their SSI check. So that's something that has to be, you know, kind of balanced out. And there's two ways to do the trust. I mean, if it's a large amount of money, you may want to have your own trust where a family member is a trustee. Or sometimes if it's a smaller amount of money or spend down, as we talk about sometimes, there are nonprofits that set these up, pool trusts. We talk a lot about the pool trust for income, but it also can be used if you have assets. So I've had clients use that sometimes when they only receive, you know, a few thousand dollars and maybe they want to put it aside. But if you're talking about something large, an inheritance, you may want to set up your own supplemental needs trust.
So if I set it up for, like, let's say myself, could I still use it, like, for him, but just have it under my name or something like that?
Yeah, so if you wanted to, you could set it up. That would be a third-party trust. You'd be the grantor. You'd be setting up the trust. You could even, you know, be the trustee, and he would be the beneficiary. So you could put money in there, he's the beneficiary, and then you could use it for different things that he needs.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's basically what I wanted to know. How much does it cost to set something like that up?
Generally, I'm sorry, we don't want to talk prices on the air because everyone is different, but, you know, give us a call at the during the week, it's and we can go into more detail with that.
Sure. All right. Well, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
All right. You're welcome.
Take care.
All right, guys. Time for the first break of the hour. You all set?
Yes.
You've been listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. Join us every week to learn more about protecting the assets you've worked hard for, options available for Medicaid planning, and more. With offices located in Corporate Woods in Albany, West Harrison Street in Saratoga Springs, Executive Woods in Clifton Park, and 130 North Front Street in Kingston. Our attorneys are here to help you. If you'd like to schedule an appointment to speak with David, Jane Marie, or Harry, please call us during normal business. business hours Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. To contact us at our Albany office, call 518-465-7581. Our Saratoga Springs office, 518-581-8131. Our Clifton Park office at 518-952-4010. And our Kingston office at 845-338-6405. Let the Herzog Law Firm help navigate a plan that works for you and your family. Now back to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
And welcome back. I'm Jane Marie Schaefer.
And I'm Kim Hance.
And we're here to continue our discussion of estate planning, Medicaid planning, elder law issues. You can give us a call. We can help you with your questions. The call-in number is 518-476-5900, and we would love to hear from you. So we've been talking with Kim Hance, who is a care manager who works for our firm and helps our clients, and, you know, kind of delving into what she does and what she can offer to our clients. And I want to ask you, Kim, about a common situation that comes up with our clients. I get calls on this almost every week. So I had a, you know, individual call. Their father is in a nursing home and in rehab, I should say, not in the nursing home yet. And they really would love to bring him home, okay? But they're trying to decide if they're able to, if there's enough, you know, supports they have at home, or if he really does require placement. And usually when someone asks me that, I mean, I can tell them how to become financially eligible for home care Medicaid, but I usually want them to talk to you as well to see if home care is possible or where the placement is best for him. And so how do you kind of go about assessing that with a family?
Right. So that's a multi-tiered question, right? And so a lot of times, you know, we find families, they sort of get stuck because they're being told one thing and really the reality of the situation is completely different. And this is actually one of the things that we really kind of dissected at our caregiver conference. A lot of times, you know, being in the hospital or being in rehab, there's what's considered 24-hour care, you know, available. What I explain to folks is that, you know, what they mean by that is, yes, there's an RN that's, you know, particularly in a nursing home, that's there 24 hours a day, and there's staff 24 hours a day, but it doesn't necessarily mean that your loved one is at any less risk because, you know, particularly at night, there's one aide maybe to, you know, 10 or 12 folks on the floor because, you know, generally you're supposed to be sleeping, things like that. But it doesn't mean that really there's any less reduction in risk or accident happening if somebody decides that they want to get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, right? So we kind of really talk about, well, what is 24-hour care mean and what does it mean when somebody's being told that their loved one requires 24-hour care? And maybe an individual doesn't need that. So we kind of talk about, ideally, we want to have a meeting with the rehab staff and really understand what that individual needs and what they need assistance with. And sometimes, in a lot of circumstances, somebody might need some physical assistance getting up in the morning, getting to, you know, getting dressed, getting maybe a shower, and having somebody there for safety reasons, just to make sure that they're steady on their feet, or, you know, just to help them with some of those activities of daily living. Maybe they need to help with some meal preparation, some reminders to take their medications, things like that. So a few hours in the morning, a few hours maybe in the afternoon, evening are good enough for that, because once they get set and settled for the day, they're okay. You know, some folks might need a larger range of assistance because maybe they didn't rehab so well, and maybe now they're taxed with a, you know, a permanent physical disability that keeps them from going up and down stairs, keeps them from being able to get in and out of the shower safely. Maybe now they're using a walker, which they've never used before. So we want to talk about the layout of the home. We want to make sure that the house is going to be safe for them, and, you know, how do they get in and out of the house? So are there steps to navigate? Are you know, what happens in the wintertime when we get the snows that we get? You know, how does somebody safely get in and out of their home? We want to talk about geographic location. That's so important. You know, the area that our offices covers, we just heard from Kingston, you know, all the way, you know, north, upwards to the Canadian border. We have very varying ranges of very rural geographic areas. And, you know, while we might be able to get somebody approved for Medicaid and get them approved for a lot of hours, we're in a period of time where staffing is very scarce. So we want to make sure that it's an area that can be served and served well. And, you know, a lot of times we look at outside resources, you know, are there family around? Is there, you know, a church in the area that can provide some support? You know, maybe we're going to look at a live-in. And that's something that we've been utilizing more and more because it is a 24-hour person. Even though that person is not working 24 hours a day, they're there. And in the event that there's an emergency at night, or in the event that there's maybe a little bit of assistance needed. So, you know, we're going to talk about all that. Family support is super important. It's really hard to bring somebody home when there's no, you know, family or, you know, extended assistance, even, you know, to help with doctor's appointments or managing some of those types of tasks in grocery shopping. You know, it's much different living in an urban area where you can just hop on and, you know, do Instacart or, you know, Go-Go Grandparents is another service that we use a lot to help with transportation and getting groceries and meals and things like that. So we want to make sure it's an area that can be served with some of those ancillary services. And we also might talk about technology. You know, how can we outfit the home of technology that will be very helpful to the individual? Again, somebody may not need a body there 24 hours a day, but having the ability to press a button if a need is required, or maybe somebody takes a fall. And so we outfit with them with a life alert with a fall detector so that notifies if there's something wrong happens. So lots of ways that we can provide a lot of support and services. And we also have to make sure that the individual is open to it because there's nothing worse than getting somebody home and then that individual firing all of the supports that are put in place and then having a crisis, right? So we want to make sure that, that the individual and the family is open to receiving services and sort of building that plan, you know, to help keep them safe at home, because really ultimately that's what our goal is to make sure that, you know, it's safe and it's sustainable, because financially, as we all know, it's very, very expensive. And so we want to make sure we're utilizing all the resources available to be able to provide both that safety and, you know, sustainability from a financial aspect.
That's right. And then, and talking about family support, one thing I want to mention is even if you have a spouse at home, right, and sometimes spouses don't want to admit that they need help, you know, so having, because the spouse may have some medical issues of their own, or they may be getting older and not able to perhaps help that person get up and move, but a lot of times you're going to face resistance there, right? And it's kind of about convincing the couple that they need to get help in the home.
Absolutely. And that's usually one of our biggest challenges is having the, you know, the primary well caregiver kind of recognize that that they can't do it all. And maybe they can start off with that. But again, when I talk about sustainability, I'm not talking, I mean, I am talking finances, but I'm also talking from a care perspective. I mean, is that caregiver going to be able to be, you know, sustainable? Yesterday, I met with a family that I've been working with off and on for, you know, probably the last 16 months. And really, it's just been kind of checking in and, you know, doing some of that family coaching and talking about some of the resources. And, you know, she really thought after all of the time that we've sort of talked about the resources and what's out there. So she's caring with her husband who has Parkinson's, but he also has, he's also been diagnosed with Alzheimer's as well. So he's got a physical mobility issue as well as the cognitive part. And, you know, while he's doing okay, she's just getting to the point where she feels like, she's missing out on some of her family events. You know, she can't really travel anymore. She's got grandkids that she wants to see and spend time with. But the guilt of leaving her husband behind or, you know, going and doing something without him has really been, you know, on her mind. So she reached out and she said, I think I'm ready for respite care, at least for the winter. He needs to go to nursing home sort of thing. And so we're like, okay, here's some of the steps. I said, but well, let's do a visit and let's just make sure that, because I'd kind of talked to her over the phone and I said, so what are his needs? How has he declined? And she was still very, well, it sounds like he's still very capable of doing some things. And so I said to her, I think maybe he'd be more appropriate for assisted living and maybe not nursing home level of care. So I did a home visit and, you know, as it turns out, he's very appropriate for assisted living. So, you know, again, having a care manager, you know, kind of go in and really evaluate the circumstances and be able to say, like, you know, and an assisted living, of course, is much nicer and he will thrive, I believe, much more in an assisted living environment than he would in a nursing home environment. So I think, you know, really helping people understand the sort of the nuances of all that's out there. And a lot of times we decide that home care isn't the place, but okay, rehab and a long-term care facility isn't either. So let's explore some of the other options that are out there. And, you know, we're lucky to have really great community partners that we work with that, you know, they only solely focus on housing, right? And understand and know all of the housing options that are out there. And really that's their focus. So being able to collaborate and use the community partners that we have through the firm has been a wonderful, you know, resource and asset to our clients because they come to us and maybe the thing that they're coming to us isn't our specialty, but in our Rolodex or, you know, we have the ability to say, this is the person that you need.
People don't know what a Rolodex is.
Oh, right. Well, well, they would know what a Rolodex was. That's why I used it. If you and I know what a Rolodex is,
we know what it is.
Maybe the younger population doesn't know, but you know, you open your phone, you go to your contacts or you go to your resources. Yeah. And, but I think that's one thing too, that we're really good at is building those relationships with our community partners that are out there so that when our clients come to us, we can say, this is the person you need to speak to and is going to be able to help you and, you know, do a warm introduction and a warm handoff. And that's one of the things that I love about being a care manager is being able to, you know, say to families, this person I know is going to be able to help you. I'm not giving you a list, I'm not sending you on your way with a bunch of phone numbers. You know, we're actually building those relationships with folks so that we know that they're a trustworthy source of both information and, you know, ability to help somebody kind of meet whatever goal it is that they want to meet.
Right, that's great. And I did want to pick up on one thing you mentioned. And, you know, I think people know in general that assisted living is a lower level of care than a nursing home. And generally they're nicer. But what kind of determines when you can stay at assisted living and when you can't stay there and you have to go to a nursing home?
So it generally depends on the licensure of the nursing home. So, you know, I'll use a couple from yesterday. You know, his big issue right now, I mean, he's ambulatory. He can do a lot for himself. He's a little bit slower because of the Parkinson's. And he's not what we call an elopement risk. So that would mean that we're worried about him wandering and trying to leave a facility. So, you know, just because he has a diagnosis of Alzheimer's doesn't necessarily mean that we need to narrow it down to a memory care. However, saying that, we know that Alzheimer's is a progressive disease, right? So it's only going to get worse. It doesn't get better. So he has some incontinence issues. So we want to look at, you know, the facilities that offer, so there's regular assisted living, there's enriched, there's all these words that describe assisted living, but an enhanced assisted living seemed to be the best fit for him, because an enhanced assisted living can even help folks that are bedbound. So they can use specialty equipment like a Hoyer lift, or, you know, deal with a higher level of almost nursing home level of care to keep the individual aging in place. And, you know, we talk about aging in place, and a lot of people think from a home standpoint, but we're also talking about aging in place from even a care facility standpoint. Maybe somebody decides that they downsize and move to an independent living. You know, we want to be able to offer the opportunity for those folks to age in place in that now independent living community. Or, you know, let's choose an assisted living that's going to allow them to age in place. So luckily, as, you know, Kismet or the universe would have it, one of our local enhanced memory care assisted livings had a bed to become available. That's where we're going to look at placing him, because we feel like they're going to be able to meet his needs through the duration of his disease and what's going to happen. We can bring hospice in, you know, as part of his plan, should that be needed in the future. And it's just a really great way. You know, I felt so good when I left there yesterday, because I was like, you know, nursing homes are really struggling right now, and we were able to sort of, and from an affordability standpoint, right? Like, you know, nursing homes are very expensive, and this is a family that will you know, be private pay for a while, because they've done some great planning and they've got it set up so that it's not going to be a burden to the wife, you know, to be able to do that. But the assisted living is going to be, you know, about 2/3 of the cost of the nursing home. So, you know, right there, she's going to be able to save a lot and hopefully keep him there for the long term, for the duration.
Right. I know that's really great. Assisted livings are, you know, a really great opportunity in the middle, in between like home care and nursing home care. And we always say when we talk about aging in place, it's not necessarily at home. It's really in a, you know, place that you're comfortable and that's suitable for you and kind of out of the nursing home. We still have time for another caller. You can give us a call at 518-476-5900. We're happy to take your questions. And so I think, yeah, some of the services that you do came in evaluating, and you kind of are combining in your social, like medical knowledge and social knowledge and kind of everything to help kind of see where someone would be best placed. So when we go for a home care application, there's some similar assessments that have to be done by the different programs, and kind of without getting into detail with all of the different programs that are available. I know it's helpful to have someone like you talk to the families in advance about what assessments are going to be done next before they can receive home care.
Right.
And that process is constantly changing, as we've seen with the, there's been a lot of changes in community Medicaid rules over the past year and two. Can you just give a little preview, so to speak, of what would happen if you applied for community Medicaid? What kind of assessments could you expect to come?
Sure. You know, generally speaking, you know, we have to financially qualify for Medicaid, but we also have to medically qualify for Medicaid. And the biggest thing that we're looking for from the medical standpoint is that you're going to need to receive care for more than 120 days, right? Whatever's happening now has led to long-term care, and you're going to need long-term services for more than 120 days. And, you know, so there's an initial assessment that is done with a nurse that kind of goes through all of your needs, activities of daily living, things like that. That's sent in once it's approved that, okay, yes, from the nurse's perspective, you know, they plug it into a computer, a formulary, of course, that, you know, spits out a score. And based on that score, it then gets pushed on to a panel to be, you know, then there's a clinical assessment that's done, a more thorough clinical assessment that's done. And once those are completed, it's then working with the different programs that are out there to sort of choose what is going to be the best fit. you know, whether it's utilizing a program where we can use Consumer Direct, whether it's, you know, one of the programs that we use a lot, the NHTD waiver, the nursing home, you know, transition diversion waiver. And that's, you know, again, from our perspective, there are a lot of law firms out there that do Medicaid applications and get people qualified, but then people don't know what happens next. Right. And I do a lot of coaching with the families, like when you have the assessment, this is the way you need to look at it. This is the way you need to answer these questions. Because a lot of times we don't think about, you know, there may be an individual that has a lot of support that relies on the family member or the primary caregiver. Well, what happens if that primary caregiver isn't able to perform those tasks? You know, so a lot of what I do when I work with families is I'm like, you need to answer the question based on that support system not being there. You know, if this individual was alone, how would these tasks get done, or how would they be completed? And really look at it from that perspective. And, you know, as we know, with all chronic illnesses, there are good days and bad days. You know, we really want to look at it from the worst case scenario or the worst day that person has had, because we never know what the worst day is going to be. So we want to make sure that we're covered for that worst day.
I'm sorry, guys. We have another phone call here if you'd like to take it.
Sure.
And it's Marie from... Marie from East Greenbush. Hi, Marie.
Hi, how are you?
Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Yes.
Okay, I have a quick question. I have a life insurance policy on myself, and my question is, if I have to go into a nursing home, is it a myth that they eventually take my life insurance money away from me? I'm still paying on it the whole life.
Sure. So, okay, I was going to ask you if it's term or if it's whole life. So it's a whole life policy. And with a whole life policy, there's a cash value, right? And you don't have to say what that amount is, but there's a cash value associated with that policy.
Yes, so I have a cash.
So you have a cash value, right? And you know what
that
is.
Yes.
So that cash value, when you apply for Medicaid counts that as an asset of yours. So that goes into your overall asset count, right, to see if you're eligible for Medicaid. And if you're applying for Medicaid, you can't have more than $16,800. So they would take whatever you have in the bank and plus your cash value and add that together. And then if it's more than that $16,800 limit, you would have to spend down.
Okay.
Yeah.
My next question is, if I cash that in now, do I have that five year? I still have a 5 year lookout. Is that what they call it?
look back.
Has my husband passed away.
you could cash it in, or what? Even a better thing to do is you could transfer the ownership of that policy to. Do you have children?
Yes.
Yeah, you could transfer ownership of the policy to your children. It's still a life insurance policy on you, but they would be the owner. And now that means that cash value wouldn't count. You don't have to count it as your asset.
Oh, okay. I only have them as my beneficiary, but I do have them as my power of attorney.
Right, so you would want to make them the owner of that policy. Now,
okay.
There's a five-year look-back period if you do change the ownership to them.
Okay.
But it's something to consider, you know, kind of overall, that may be worth doing that to get that cash value out of your name so it's not counted.
Right. Okay. I was just wondering about that. Thank you very much.
Oh, bye. You're welcome. Bye. All right, that's a good question. We probably have time maybe to squeeze in one more call if you want to call. It's 518-476-5900. And we were talking about how, you know, Kim goes through assessments and evaluations with clients as they're getting ready to apply for community Medicaid. And it's a complicated process. I mean, there's many stages to the process of applying for community Medicaid. I mean, we get you financially and legally set up, you know, and then Kim helps you through the assessments, which is an important piece of it. But not every, as you said, firm that does Medicaid applications
does for you. They just kind of say, all right, you're financially eligible. Now you have to figure out the next part on your own. And there's a lot more steps to do after that, even down to getting the aids in place and set up in your home, right, Kim?
Correct, correct. So it's really reviewing all the necessary, you know, things that that need to happen, for sure.
That's right. And there could even be another step, which is the, I'm bringing up something we don't have time to go into. There's a pooled income trust that was one of the pieces that qualifies you for Medicaid, and people kind of need guidance on how to use that trust to use that money to pay for their expenses. But that's something you could always learn more about at our Aging in Place webinar. Those webinars are on our website if you want to watch them. We just had webinar week this past week. Webinar week is we do a series of webinars Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday at 2 o'clock. We do them once a month, so next month in October you could catch that. Or if you want to just look at the pre-recorded ones, you can go onto our website under seminars.
That's right. Lots of great information available there.
That's right. And, you know, I want to thank you, Kim, for all that you do with our clients. It's really great to have you on the team. You know, as I said, there's a lot more to elder law planning than just, you know, okay, let's get your power of attorney done, let's get a trust done, right? There's so much more pieces that go into it in terms of having to plan to take care of a family member.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I love and, you know, love about our firm is, you know, just because you come in and your documents are done doesn't mean you can't reach out and ask questions. You know, we meet with families all the time when, you know, an event has happened or something changes. And we always encourage, you know, clients and non-clients alike, right? People may have decided for some reason to go to a different firm or and have gotten their documents done. But I meet with people all the time that, they have questions and I'm like, bring your documents in. Let's review them. Let's make sure that they align with your goals. Because that's the other thing is we just want to make sure that these are the golden years and that we kind of take that worry out for you.
Thank you for listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. For more information on their services, please visit herzoglaw.com. If you'd like to speak with one of their attorneys, please contact the Albany office at 518-465-7581, the Saratoga office at 518-581-8131, or their Kingston office at 845-338-6405.